I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never.
Hello and welcome to A Public Affair. It's Tuesday, so that means you've got me. I'm Carousel Baird. Thanks so much for joining us. We have a great show today. We are going to talk about campaign finance. This seems to be relevant all the time. There's always an article in the paper talking about how we're changing the campaign finance rules and how the U.S. Supreme Court is making a decision, the state Supreme Courts are making a decision, the state house is making a decision. It just gets really complicated. So we have with us joining today Mike McCabe, the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. Thank you, Mike, for joining us.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
It's wonderful to have you. So, you know, we were talking beforehand about how complicated this could be. We could talk forever about tiny little minute details. But first, let's start with the big picture, which is, what are all the different ways that someone can contribute to a campaign? So someone's running. Last week we had two candidates running for assembly, Mark Clear and Lisa Subek. They were running for assembly. So let's say you wanted to, you heard the show, you think one of them is wonderful, you want to donate money to them in some way. What are the different ways that they get money?
Individuals can make donations, obviously. So somebody who supports a candidate can write a check and send in a donation to the campaign.
There are limits.
There are limits on how much you can give. So individuals are limited. Now, interest groups can also form political action committees, and those committees are registered committees. They have to file campaign finance reports. They have to disclose their sources of income, but they also can make donations to candidates.
And what is an interest group? Anything could be an interest group. My neighborhood association. I'm in Midvale Heights, and we care about someone running for, you know, city council next year. We want them to care about the park.
Yeah.
Could Midvale Heights form a nonprofit?
Yeah, you know, in fact, there have been PACs formed at the state level that don't appear to be more than one person, or it's a collection of people in a neighborhood. Any group of people who have like interests, or even corporations can form their own PACs. There's Coke PAC, which is the Political Action Committee of Coke Industries. So these are registered political committees. They can give directly to candidates. There are limits on the donations. They also can then sponsor their own advertising, and there is no limit on the advertising that they can themselves sponsor try to influence elections.
You've already caught me up there by saying that it could just be an individual. So I, Carousel Baird, want to give to Mike McCabe. You're running for Congress. Or let's make it a more of a local because I know some of those numbers. So you're running for assembly. The individual contribution limit for assembly in Wisconsin is
$500? $500 from an individual, $500 from a PAC.
Okay. So I can write you a check from Carousel Baird to Mike McCabe for assembly, $500.
Correct.
And then I can form a PAC, of which the PAC is only, it's the Carousel PAC. And I can write you a check for $500.
Correct. We've certainly seen PACs that do appear to be nothing more than a person or a small collection of individuals. And then we, on the other end of the spectrum, we see PACs like Coke PAC that represent an entire corporation and its interests.
I mean, right there, though, that seems crazy. I mean, so if I really want to make someone love me, instead of giving them $500, I've now figured out a way to give them $1,000.
Right, you know,
because I'm going to form my own group, but all I have to do is register, fill out some paperwork, which nobody reads. You might look at it, but Nobody even knows it exists.
Right. And you know, that used to be about the extent to which people could get around campaign contribution limits. Now there are countless ways that wealthy individuals can get around campaign contribution limits, and there are new avenues being opened up all the time because of court rulings. But, you know, now, you know, we have had some of the strongest campaign contribution limits and some of the strongest disclosure requirements anywhere in the country.
State of Wisconsin?
We had those in Wisconsin. And now those laws really aren't worth much more than the paper they're written on, because there are easy ways to get around those limits. There are also easy ways to get around those disclosure requirements. If you want to give unlimited amounts of money to get somebody elected and you want that to be kept secret, there are now ways to do that. And that's the real scandal of campaign finance today, is that we still have laws on the books that appear to put some limits on this activity and that certainly appear to be aimed at creating transparency so the public can see who's really paying to put somebody in office. But those laws are now easily circumvented, and there are groups that have been formed for the clear purpose of getting around those laws and really operating outside of campaign finance laws that used to be some of the strongest in the country and now, like I said, really are next to worthless.
So when you say that they're created for the purpose, does that mean that we, every time we see a law, does someone create an entity to get around that law? Is that sort of how these groups came about?
Well, certainly in the area of campaign finance. I can't speak for, you know, all areas of the law, obviously, but in the campaign finance arena, what we've seen is this steady progression of legal activity aimed at subverting campaign finance laws. We had some very strong protections against corruption in Wisconsin. And there's just been a systematic effort, both legislatively, administratively, and legally in court, sort of a three-pronged assault on those laws aimed at subverting those laws and being able to get around them. And we're now at the point where wealthy interests are able to get around campaign contribution limits, and they're able to get around disclosure requirements. It is now possible, and it's being done. It's not just possible, it's being done.
Actual.
Yep, where unlimited amounts of money are being poured into certain campaigns to get certain people elected or certain other people defeated, and the sources of that money are impossible to trace. It's the phenomenon of what, you know, in this trade is called dark money. Dark money is just money used for a political purpose to influence the outcome of an election, but it's money that cannot be traced to its origins.
So let's sort of go through a scenario. So back to the, I want you to win. Mike is running for assembly. I want Mike to win. I will do whatever I can do, whatever I can do legally, but we're going to explain how you're telling all these things are legal. You're allowed to do all these things. Okay, so I gave my $500 to you, Carousel Baird, gave $500. That's nice.
You can donate to a PAC.
Right? The Carousel PAC has donated $500 to you, but that you have to list. You have to list that Carousel
Correct.
Baird donated $500. You have to list that the Carousel PAC donated
right.
$500. What are other things now that I can do where no one even knows what it is?
Well, you could, you know, if you can pool enough money in your PAC to be able to then go out and sponsor your own advertising on behalf of a candidate, you can give the legal donations. And for an example, a Koch PAC gave Scott Walker $43,000 for his 2010 election. That's the most that a PAC could give directly to a candidate for governor.
For governor.
Correct.
Which right there is insane.
But
one PAC can give $43,000. Crazy. Okay.
But they didn't want to stop at putting $43,000 behind the effort to get Scott Walker elected. They then routed money through a variety of groups, dark money groups, and by our best accounting, because we looked at the TV ad buy invoices.
You saw what was there and you had to figure somebody paid for this somewhere.
We looked for how much advertising Americans for Prosperity bought on pro-Walker ads. And for his elections, it's been about $5 million.
So,
now, David Phillips, the president of Koch, of Americans for Prosperity, the Koch-based group, claimed that they spent more than $10 million on Walker. We can't see where that money might have been spent. We did go around to TV stations and find invoices showing TV ad purchases that put the price
did
tag
TV
up around $5
million. Did TV stations have to give that to you? Or they just were willing to?
You know, TV stations are required to keep a public file that shows political ad spending, but they're not technically required by law to show the so-called issue ad groups, these outside interest groups. But we got wonderful cooperation from Wisconsin TV stations in sharing that information with us, and it was a crucial piece of our research in showing the magnitude of Americans for Prosperity's involvement in on behalf of Scott Walker. But there's an example where they gave as much as they legally could through their registered political action committee, but then they routed money through a variety of other organizations that spent millions. And really the only limit was the self-imposed limit by the Koch brothers and how much money they wanted to pour into the campaign.
Could these other campaigns then, can they, just so I know, because this is almost a very naive question, can they put in their advertisement anything they want? So it doesn't have to be, we believe in free speech, we believe in, you know, please vote for Scott Walker because we believe in this issue. It can just flat out be Scott Walker, he's the best, we love him.
Now if you run the money through a political action committee, you could do advertising that comes right out and says vote for Scott Walker or vote against Tom Barrett or whatever you want it to say. But if you run the money through a political action committee, you do have to reveal the source of the income. You do have to reveal the donors.
Okay, so the dark money, though.
So they could give $43,000 directly to Scott Walker. They could have used Koch PAC to sponsor a bunch of advertising and spend as much as they wanted, but they would have had to show where Koch PAC got that money. So what they instead did is they sponsored the advertising through Americans for Prosperity, which is a tax-exempt social welfare group that doesn't have to disclose its donors. And as a result, they could spend the money unaccountably. They could spend it without revealing.
How does Americans for Prosperity have the right to do that? Do they then have to have their ads catered a certain way so that they don't cross the line into...
Yes. And that's what I call the magic words loophole. A political action committee that wants to spend money, they can donate to a candidate directly and help the candidate fund his or her own campaign, but then they can also spend, supposedly independently, they could spend as much as they want of their PAC's money, but they have to disclose donors. But they can come right out and say vote for or vote against. A group that wants to operate outside of campaign finance laws can't use words like vote for or vote against or elect or defeat or support or oppose. But if you look at their ads, you know, it'll say that a candidate is out of touch or doesn't reflect Wisconsin values or it'll sing the praises of other candidates and say that you know, thanks to that candidate, Wisconsin is working again and it's morning in Wisconsin. Everything's getting better.
So you can still name them.
And they name the candidates. They make it very apparent that they're engaged in election season political advertising, but they very carefully they avoid the use of the so-called magic words. And that comes from a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that said if you don't use those words, it's not a political ad. It doesn't have a political purpose. Well, if you look at these ads, you watch them or listen to them, they don't have any purpose but a political.
So those are all the ads.
So that's one of the big shams, one of the farces that's been perpetrated on us is this idea that if you don't say certain magic words, your ad doesn't have a political purpose.
So this is fascinating to have this conversation because I knew everything that you were saying, but to hear you say it, I wonder with the listeners out there if this is sort of bringing in your memory ads that you've seen that always sort of have a strange ending to them, but you don't, you sort of push that aside, that are like, hey, call your blah blah blah, like, or this isn't the way Wisconsin wants to go, and it puts a big sticker on them, but it doesn't say vote for Scott Walker, but you know it's a vote for Scott Walker, vote for Tom Barrett,
right.
I mean, and this is on both sides of the fence.
Correct. And actually what you mentioned is one of the telltale signs of one of these so-called phony issue ads. They're really political ads, but they're masquerading as just issue discussion. And one of the telltale signs is when they give you a number to call at the end and say, call so-and-so and give them a piece of your mind.
Right.
They do that because they don't want to end the ad by saying, vote for so-and-so or defeat this other candidate. They're playing a semantic game to do sort of a two-step around campaign finance laws, both contribution limits and disclosure requirements.
Now, and tell me if I'm jumping around too much and this isn't related, but so wasn't there a state Supreme Court decision that dealt with a million things, but part of it was that the GAB was trying to define what is, the words they were using was an if issue advocacy versus express.
Mm-hmm.
Advocacy, express meaning direct, perhaps, versus issue meaning the less tangible, but
one is considered to have a political purpose and the other's
one
not.
One isn't. And they had a rule in there about anything within 30 days of an election by default is express.
Well, actually,
and that was struck down?
Actually, what the Government Accountability Board did is borrowed language directly from Chief Justice John Roberts, who wrote in a U.S. Supreme Court case, he basically provided us with a definition for how to regulate these phony issue ads. What Justice Roberts said is that if an ad is done in an election season, and the GAB actually chose a 60-day window within 60 days of an election, if a message is during an election season and identifies a candidate, and here were Roberts' words, and is susceptible of no reasonable interpretation other than an appeal to vote for or against a candidate, then it can be subject to regulation. Then it can be subject to campaign contribution limits and disclosure requirements. So the GAB wrote a rule that used Justice Roberts' own words, and yet our state Supreme Court and a federal court, subsequently said, nah, the rule can't stand.
60 days is too nebulous.
Well, they basically, hitched their wagon to the idea that they did not believe that the GAB had the legal authority to pass these rules.
Ah,
now, the irony.
So it could still be a rule of the state?
Oh, I don't think there's any question that state lawmakers could pass this as a law and it would be upheld. Legal attack was based on was with the GAB is exceeding its legal authority in writing this rule.
Okay.
I think that's nonsense because the old rule that we're now left with is the magic words test. The GAB has
so they were trying to narrowly define the law as it is to fit within the paramounts of the Supreme Court decisions.
What state law says is that if you do something for a political purpose, it's subject to regulation. It's subject to campaign contribution limits and disclosure requirements. If your message, if your spending is done for a political purpose, that's what the law says.
So even if there's a message that says, call your senator. So for disclosure, and we talked about this, I'm on the board of NARAL Pro-Choice Wisconsin Foundation. So we're the nonprofit side, we're the foundation. And we do ads that say, do you think it's, we'll talk about a subject of reproductive rights. Do you think it's a woman should have this right? Call your senator and let him know or something like that. Would that sometimes when there's an issue coming forward, is that election related or not?
If the message is generally distributed and you're basically telling everybody call your senator and you're giving them the legislative hotline number, it's not targeted to a particular election. It's not targeted to a particular candidate. It's not within 60 days of an election. It never would have been seen as a campaign ad.
Well, that's a lot of rules, though. So here's
the thing. The law says that if you do something for a political purpose, you have to tell the people of Wisconsin where your money comes from and that you're doing it. And you also have to obey campaign contribution limits. You can't use corporate money. You can't use unlimited funds from wealthy individuals. Well, so the old elections board and the current government accountability board have to interpret what it means, what political purpose means. The rule that we're stuck with is the magic words test. If you don't use words like vote for, vote against, elect or defeat, your ad has no political purpose. It's not deemed a political ad at all.
But nobody believes that except the Supreme Court. I mean, that's a joke.
Well, and the Supreme Court doesn't even believe that because Justice Roberts said that one thing you could do is have a test that says if an ad is done close to an election and identifies a candidate and is susceptible of no reasonable interpretation other than as an appeal to elect or defeat a candidate, then you can treat that as a political ad. That's what the GAB passed. the old interpretation of the meaning of political purpose was replaced with Justice Roberts' new test, and it got thrown out because they said, well, the GAB doesn't have the authority to do this. The legislature would have to act. And, of course, the legislature hasn't acted and won't act. So one of the things that I think people have to take out of this is that the mess that we're in currently is not just the doing of the Citizens United decision. It's the doing of a whole series of court decisions that drop bombs on our democracy. But it's also the doing of election authorities that have not aggressively enforced the law. And it's also the doing of lawmakers who have not reformed our laws to make them effective again. We're stuck with old laws, some of which have had holes poked in them, some of which have been overturned in court. But even where the Supreme Court in the Citizens United decision invited Congress and invited states to create new disclosure requirements, legislatures and Congress haven't done so. The GAB tried and then was told, no, you don't have the legal authority. This would take an act of the legislature. So this is something that lawmakers are to blame for, election officials are to blame for, and the current crop of judges are to blame for this mess that we're in right now.
I'm talking with Mike McCabe. He's the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. So, Mike, okay, a couple questions off of what you just said. One is, so where are we now? Is the result, at least currently here in Wisconsin, that issue advocacy ads that don't say the magic words, that don't say vote for Mary Burke, that don't say vote for Scott Walker, that say, you know, one of these candidates supports raising the minimum wage. If you think workers deserve the right for a minimum wage, you know, call these candidates and let them know what's important to you. That ad like that, do they have free reign now?
They do. They can operate outside of the law entirely. And interests that are aiming to do even further damage to our anti-corruption protections are now pushing a new legal theory that is central to the John Doe investigation that is underway. For years, what these issue ad groups said is that we don't have anything to do with candidates, and we're not trying to influence elections. Our ads are not political ads. Even though they run around election time, these are not political ads. This is issue advocacy, and it's just about discussing issues and educating voters. It's not about trying to get candidates elected or defeated, and we don't have anything to do with the candidates. We were told that for 20 years by these issue ad outfits as they were trying to prevent rules or new laws that would require disclosure and regulation of their activity. Now they're pushing the legal theory that they should still be able to operate outside of the law and not disclose their donors and be able to spend as much as they want if they don't use those magic words. But they ought to also be able to directly coordinate with candidates. They ought to be able to plot strategy with candidates. They ought to be able to coordinate their activities with candidates. And that's what it's at the heart of the John Doe investigation. You've got groups like Wisconsin Club for Growth and a number of others, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, Wisconsin Family Action, a bunch of groups. And emails have come to light that show that these groups were coordinating directly with Friends of Scott Walker, which is Walker's campaign committee. And what Walker's defense is, and what these groups have advanced as a defense, is, well, what we did is legal. Coordination is legal. So it's really bizarre, a bizarre legal theory that for all these years they've been saying we don't have anything to do with candidates, and now they're saying, well, but we should be able to coordinate with candidates and that should be legal. They're basically saying we want to be certified as virgins, but we want to be able to sleep around at the same time. That's effectively what they're arguing, is that they're pure as the driven snow. They're just discussing issues, but they ought to be able to get right in bed with the candidates and plot strategy and coordinate activities.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about this because that is what the John Doe... That's another layer that we haven't even gotten to yet, but it looks like we have a caller coming in. Let's wait. Thanks for waiting. Tell us your name and your question or comment.
Hi, my name is Pete. My name is Pete Douglas, and my question is, we've heard a lot about how the Koch brothers are affected, and I was wondering if you could explain if there are any differences on how unions are affected and their ability to give to campaigns.
Well, the Citizens United decision said that corporations and unions and other interest groups can spend as much as they want on election campaigns. And now, unions traditionally operated out of registered political action committees. That was the longstanding tradition with labor unions. For whatever reason, they decided that they would like to have their money run through PACs. Those PACs had to disclose donors and obey contribution limits and that kind of thing. I think unions in Wisconsin obviously have seen their ability to put money into politics substantially diminished because of Act 10,
right.
the collective bargaining legislation.
Their funding isn't as big anymore.
Right.
But
I think what they're doing is starting to move in the direction of the corporations and other interest groups in using the so-called issue ad groups, you know, these tax-exempt social welfare groups to route money to them. So, and unions can do that as well as corporations. In Wisconsin, their capacity to do that's been roughly cut in half. The biggest spender on the union side in Wisconsin elections was the State Teachers Union. And in the 2010 election, we saw WEAC spend something like $2.3 million influencing state elections. In 2012, post-Act 10, it dropped to something like $946,000. So we saw their capacity roughly cut in half.
And I think this is a nonpartisan issue. I mean,
oh, it is.
And, you know, the unions, and maybe that's part of the complexity. Every time you talk, I write down another question I want to ask you. But maybe that's part of the complexity of it is that the Koch brothers want to spend all their money and they want to get their candidates elected. The unions want to spend all their money. They want to get their candidates elected. The lawsuit that we talked about was Wisconsin Right to Life. They were suing for issue advocacy. But I'm talking about my personal experience on the NARAL Foundation Board where we want to do that too. So, you know, it's both sides and it's messy and it's tricky. And is there a balance to this that makes it okay?
Well,
is there not a balance because none of it's okay?
Here's where I would here's the point that I always make when people say, hey, you know, the money's flowing on both sides are doing it. That's true. Money, there are dark money groups on the Democratic side and on the Republican side. There's money. Huge sums of money flowing on both sides. But if you look at where this money comes from, if you look at all the political money, all of it, it comes from no more than about 2% of the American population. If you look at any one candidate, they get their money from a fraction of 1% of the population, a tiny fraction of 1%. So I think the real losers here are the 98% of Americans who aren't giving anything. If the Supreme Court is right and money equals speech, that's what the court has ruled, money is speech.
Right. There's only a few people talking.
In the 2012 election, 32 donors to federal super PACs gave as much as 3.7 million Americans gave to the Obama and Romney campaigns combined. 32 donors to super PACs gave $313 million. 3.7 million Americans gave much smaller amounts each. $313 million came from those donors.
So then I bet everybody in Congress is chasing those 32 people. It doesn't matter which side you're on.
Or they're and to some extent, they're also chasing the 3.7 million who gave much smaller amounts. If money equals speech.
It's a lot harder to change.
Of course.
Chase 3.7 million than 32 people.
I mean, and that's why somebody like Sheldon Adelson, the Las Vegas casino tycoon, can summon presidential candidates, including
right.
Scott Walker,
yes.
to come out to Vegas and have a private meeting with them because he can afford to put tens of millions of dollars into a campaign. Here's my point, though. If money equals speech, then each one of those 32 super PAC donors spoke at 115,000 times the volume of each one of those 3.7 million Americans who gave much smaller amounts. And keep in mind, America is a country of well over 300 million people, 315 million. Roughly, is our nation's population. That means that well over 300 million people gave nothing at all. So if money equals speech, the mute button was on for more than 300 million Americans. 32 super PAC donors spoke with an enormous megaphone. Their voices were amplified. 3.7 million Americans spoke in sort of hushed tones, and over 300 million Americans didn't say a word. They had no voice at all if money equals speech. That's what's really That's where the real losers are found in this system. This is not a partisan problem. It's a bipartisan problem. But man, 98% of the population is paying a steep price for the kind of mess that we've gotten ourselves into.
We have some more callers coming in. Thank you so much for waiting. Tell us your name and your question or comment.
Yeah, this is John. Bush v. Gore threw the election to George W. Bush, despite Gore winning the popular vote. And every way they come, the Chads afterwards proved he also won the Florida vote, leaving aside 90,000 disenfranchised African Americans. And this led to George W. Bush appointing Robertson Alito, which leads to Citizens United, McCutcheon versus the FEC, and this latest Hobby Lobby decision. My question is this: what are the checks and balances against an out-of-control Supreme Court? Because that's what we've got. And what's going on right now, it looks like with Roberts, it's going to be repeated for another 10 years.
Mike, what do you think? I mean,
well, ultimately, the check on judicial power is the appointment power of the White
president.
House, the president, and then also the confirmation powers of the Senate. But, you know, what we've had is really sort of a, you know, almost a merger of the branches of government and all acting in the service of corporate interests or wealthy interests in our country. And to me, I think what we're going through right now is what I would describe as the third stage of ownership in America. You go back to the very beginnings of our country. The first stage of ownership was the ownership of people, where people could be property. It was slavery.
White males in charge.
Yeah, exactly. And after decades of struggle, and you know, the abolitionist movement finally won, and slavery was abolished. That didn't mean that those people who had power in society or had control over most everything in society were going to surrender control or relinquish power.
No.
So they moved on to what I would call a second stage of ownership, which was segregation, was Jim Crow, or those kinds of laws. Well, then it's interesting. Again, after decades of struggle, you had the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, you had the passage of the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, all culminating in 1973 with the enactment of Title IX, which was one of the great achievements in women's rights. I don't think it was a coincidence that it was in 1976, right on the heels of all that civil rights and women's rights legislation, it was in 1976 that the Supreme Court ruled in Buckley versus Valeo that money equals speech. To me, they started to create the third stage of ownership. They lost the first stage. They lost Jim Crow and segregation and those kinds of mechanisms. And now what they're constructing is a system of control that's based on the idea that you make speech, you make political speech and political participation prohibitively expensive for all but a few. That is the design of what I think is the third stage of ownership. Buckley plays into that. Citizens United and McCutcheon decisions all play into creating a system where political participation and political expression is prohibitively expensive for all but a very few in society.
So when we talk about Citizens United and you talk about where we are now, how do you expect any campaign finance changes to take place on a state or federal level? I mean, sometimes you sort of take a step back and are pleasantly surprised that anything happened in the first place.
Yep.
And as an elected official on the Dane County Board, I can say there's hypocrisy on both sides every once in a while. You know, that we both say, oh, we yell at the other side, and then when we're in power, we do the same thing. And then when we're not in power, we yell at them for it. I mean, how does any of this ever happen then?
Well, you know, the third stage of ownership will meet its maker when the same way that the first two stages did, and that's through citizen activism and agitation and years worth of struggle. Slavery didn't come to an end because slaveholders decided that it was an evil institution. Slavery came to an end when the abolitionist movement became powerful enough politically to bring it to an end. segregation was not renounced by the segregationists. It came to an end after the civil rights movement grew strong enough to force change. In the third stage of ownership, this idea that money is speech and corporations are people and political participation and expression is made prohibitively expensive for all but a very few in our society, that will come to an end after there is enough citizen activism and agitation to make the price of maintaining that system too high. That's where the move to amend comes in. That's where, you know, I just wrote a book that is supposed to come out in September or so that really is about where the next movement will come from, who will be involved in it, and how we can possibly break down
this. But the things that you're talking about are so much more covert. I mean, discrimination, blatant racism, blatant sexism, blatant no, you cannot vote, no, you cannot have this job, no, you cannot buy this house. That is so concrete. You can yep. see it in your face. It's much easier to develop, you know, anger and passion yep. and activism behind that. It's yep. a lot harder to have a conversation, even with, you know, I'm a civil rights activist. I'm an elected official. I wear my heart on my sleeve. I am out there fighting for rights all the time. I can tell you I've not written a single bill about campaign finance. It's not something that's really on my radar.
It will be.
And this conversation is a good call.
You know, but I tell you, they've gotten much more sophisticated in being able to basically wrap control of the masses in clothing that is so much more appealing to the eye and so much less repugnant looking. It's sort of velvet discrimination that they engage in. Look at the voter ID. Voter suppression is now, it used to be that it was literacy tests and poll taxes, and they've now gotten to the point where they say that, well, this is just to prevent voter fraud.
Do you see all that related? Is this all? It's all about votes and political power.
All of this is related, from voter suppression to the scandal of campaign financing to partisan gerrymandering of districts. It is about concentrating power and control over society in the hands of a very few. It is about making expression and participation difficult, if not impossible, for all but a few. And that's why I describe it as a distinct and separate stage of ownership. We've got to become really well acquainted with the design of this stage of ownership, because it's our job as citizens ultimately to destroy that design. And we won't destroy that design until we understand how they've done this to us. And yeah, you're right. Slavery was in your face. And so was Jim Crow. They've gotten really subtle, and they've gotten very, very ingenious about the way they have wrapped themselves in the First Amendment, and they've made this seem very, very American, what they're doing. We have to understand that design if we're ever going to shred it.
Talking with Mike McCabe, we have another call coming in. Thanks so much for waiting. Tell us your name and your question or comment.
Yeah, this is Brad in Jefferson. They've made money speech, but it's really propaganda, which has made their money power. It's sort of like a modern-day feudal system almost, where most of us have no power. I work with Move to Amend, and I'd just like to say there's votes coming up this next election in Menasha, Nina, Appleton, Green Bay, the village of Park Ridge, Fond du Lac, Ripon, and Stoughton, to say that corporations are not people, unions are not a person, and money's not speech.
Thank you for leading on that initiative and helping. And we've voted on that in Dane County already, haven't we?
We have, in the city of Madison and Dane County as
yes.
a whole. And over 500 communities nationwide have done the same, and these votes are being held even in Republican strongholds.
We need those numbers higher than 500, but right, yep. we're getting it started. I think we have another call coming in. Great. Thank you so much for waiting. Tell us your name and your question or comment.
Hello. My name is Mike. I'm struck by a certain phenomenon that the left seems to employ, and that is what I call the don't go into that room when the music comes up horror movie style. Unfortunately, the people involved in this struggle are focused primarily in an intellectual way, when the people of the right, they operate in a very pragmatic way. They basically know what they want, and then they spend every effort and money to get there, and they don't care who they have to step on in the process. I think we are mistaken if we believe that these people are noble or have interests other than their own selfishness and egotistical search for power. Therefore, we have to do what our parents should have done to the unruly children in the family, and that is discipline them. And that doesn't necessarily mean in a physical way, but you basically do not allow them to do the nasty things that they do. And that really goes back to the whole idea of, as a gentleman was saying, organization, education. Because obviously when you're living in a society that spends an awful lot of time deflecting consciousness through trivialities of entertainment and materialism, you basically are not too surprised when what you get is the current situation. So I'd like to have commentary on that. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your call. Well, and I think that's sort of the idea of you've got to rise up. And the different, you know, my comment about the, you know, it's on both sides, and it is on both sides, but, you know, we're making generalizations. Democrats sort of act with their heart, and, you know, and Republicans act a lot more with their head of, this is it. I'm going for this goal, and I'm going for it. And, you know, they don't mind what the casualties are.
Well, you know, I think one of the things we do have to come to terms with in our society is that both major parties are failing us. That doesn't mean the two parties are the same. I'm not one of those people who say that there's no difference, no discernible difference between Democrats and Republicans. That's not true. There are big differences between the two parties, but both parties are failing us. We basically have one party that is scary and another that is scared. And in fact, the extent to which one is scared is actually enabling the other to be a lot scarier than it otherwise would be able to be. And as a result, we now are in a situation where we've got levels of what I would describe as, the ranks of the politically homeless are bigger than they've been in at least three quarters of a century. If you look at polling, but also if you just talk to people out there on the street, but Gallup polling, Pew research shows that the percentage of Americans who are willing to identify as either Democrats or Republicans is at its lowest level in three quarters of a century. Most people are feeling politically homeless. In the past, that is sort of a market opportunity that people, citizens used to create movements that forced one or both of the major parties to reconnect with the people. Yeah. And I think such a moment is coming again. That's really what this book that I've written is about. It is about how to create what I would call a first party movement. I'm not advocating a third party movement. We have a two party system in America, for better or worse. The goal of a third party movement is to have three or more parties. The goal of a first party movement is to have one that's worth a damn. And I think that's where our energy has to focus is. And it's happened before. The birth of the Republican Party in the days of slavery was what I would describe as a first party movement. The progressive movement in the Gilded Age, the days of the robber barons, again, was a movement that citizens used. They established a new political identity. They used that identity to force one or both of the major parties to reconnect with the
people.
And
do you see this as more, I mean, obviously this is what you do every day, but do you see this as something that has more momentum than other issues, per se?
Oh, I think we are reaching a moment where the conditions that we face are so eerily reminiscent of the Gilded Age, the days of those robber barons, that it's like we've gone full circle right back to the 1890s in so many ways politically, and I don't think that's sustainable. I think the conditions are so ripe for that, the kind of political movements that we saw in the that were seen in the late 19th century, and there's a hunger out there. People are feeling politically homeless. They are exasperated with the political parties as they exist today. One of the things I've talked about a lot when I go out and talk to groups is that we've been trained to think horizontally about politics. We've been trained to think about who's on the left, who's on the right, who's liberal, who's conservative. If you flip the political spectrum on its head and think vertically instead of horizontally, a magical thing happens. You take a man in Clark County, where I grew up, farm country, about halfway between Eau Claire and Wausau. He's white. He's poor. Clark County is one of the five poorest counties in Wisconsin. And he's Republican. Clark County went to Scott Walker by over 30 percentage points in the recall election. Now you take a woman in Milwaukee. Let's say she's African American. Let's say she's also low income. It's a big low income population in Milwaukee. She's Democrat. She's liberal. On a horizontal spectrum, those two people couldn't be farther apart. They are polar opposites. You flip the spectrum vertically and you stop thinking about left and right and think about top and bottom.
Economics.
You think about who's on top, who's on the bottom. Think about who are the royals and who are the commoners in our society. Those two people are in exactly the same spot on the spectrum. The way we've been trained to think and talk about politics is needlessly dividing people who could be united. Well, we've got to break ourselves free of that brainwashing, of the way we've been trained to think, and begin to imagine a movement that could unite people who've been divided.
Well, you're
who've
just
had a
making
wedge.
You're making economics the deciding the issue that we're forgetting about, that we're not talking about, that is sort of the
But it's not just that. It's not just economics. If you think vertically and you think about who's on top and who's on the bottom, you can think about that economically, but you can also think about that in terms of political power. Who's got power and who doesn't?
Except that's what. To bring us full circle on the conversation of the show, the whole conversation is economics is the political power.
And
money
that,
is the political.
And, you know,
speech.
That's something else that we've got to break free of. We've all been conditioned to believe that there's only one political currency that matters, and that's money. I can think of at least two other political currencies that had enormous political power, that had enormous power in the past, organized people and provocative ideas. Those two currencies were married by the progressives, and the marriage of those two currencies proved powerful enough to overcome the organized money of Standard Oil and the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and the Vanderbilts. We've been conditioned to believe that there's only one currency that matters. And look at the Democratic Party today. No offense to Mary Burke, but she was chosen as the, she was anointed as the candidate for the Democratic Party for one reason.
I'm not sure I'll agree with the chosen, the anointed, although I do agree that lots of people think that.
But
yes.
the party establishment wants her for one reason.
I don't agree with the one reason, but I will agree that it was easy for her to rise to the top because she has something inherently that other people don't have right off the bat, which is financial stability. Overwhelming financial stability and strength that is needed to run for office.
And we've got to figure out how to get other political currencies back into circulation. Because the progressives faced the Koch brothers and the Walton families of their era, Standard Oil, the Rockefellers, the Vanderbilts, the Carnegies, and they were able to marry two political currencies that proved potent enough to overcome organized money. We've grown convinced that there's no way to overcome organized money. We have to liberate ourselves from that brainwashing if we're going to deal with this third stage of ownership.
So this is not where I thought this conversation would go. I really like that. We're not talking about campaign finance
per se.
We're talking about the philosophical, the role of money in American society And in politics, but the impact that it has in everything else.
If discussions of campaign finance are just about conduits and political action committees and super PACs, and that's
so
all so
boring.
Dweebish.
Oh, come on.
What we have to talk about is how money is playing a role in establishing political power and what we could do about it to break free.
Well, I did want to ask a quick question about the John Doe decision, not to pull us back, and we only have a few minutes, so maybe we don't even have time to talk about it. But I did. You made mention a little bit. So the John Doe decision creates this new rule of coordination, which I think ties into all of
this. They're trying to create that new rule.
So the decision says what they did, even if they did it, is not illegal because there's no problem with coordinating with the campaign. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Judge Rudolph Randa bought their legal theory. And he's a district court judge at the federal level. He doesn't have the final say on this.
Sure.
It goes up to the federal appeals court. The Seventh Circuit's going to have to decide this. It could make it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
But it's an opinion that's the standing one right now. And it's a legal theory that he's given some weight to it because the judge agreed to it.
He says these groups should be able to operate outside the law but also coordinate directly with candidates.
And that's a line that had been drawn up till now.
Well,
it's still there.
It was settled law in Wisconsin for decades that these kinds of groups could not coordinate with candidates. In fact, Justice John Wilcox was heavily fined when his campaign was found to be coordinating with a group called the Wisconsin Coalition for Voter Participation, which was one of these phony issue ad groups.
So part of the idea was to bring us back to what we were talking at the beginning of there's these separate groups that if they don't say the magic words, they're not advocating for a candidate. They're just talking about other things. And another rule, which we didn't mention, was they don't work with the candidate because that would be too close to being political with the candidate. But now they're arguing we're still not saying the magic words, so we're not fighting for that candidate to be elected, but we're going to tell him what we're doing, and he's going to tell us if he likes it or not, and we're going to coordinate.
Yep, we want to be legally designated as virgins, but we want to sleep with the candidates anyway. And that's what it boils down to. Now, if this makes
you can't, as long as you have access to birth control, which you don't anymore.
If this makes it to the Supreme Court, it's going to be interesting to see the kind of legal gymnastics the court majority would have to go through, because so far they've said that these groups should be able to say as much as they want, and because they're not coordinating with candidates.
Right, so now they have to...
Their activity is not corrupting because they're not coordinating with candidates. The Supreme Court drew a line and said that it's only corrupting if they're coordinating with the candidates.
And now we have something that crosses that line.
Exactly.
So, well, Mike, thank you so much. This has been a great conversation. I really appreciate your passion and your ability to take this issue that I wanted to talk about and extrapolate it on a larger scale, which, you know, was really fascinating to talk about from my end, and I hope the listeners appreciated it too. We're talking with Mike McCabe, the executive director of Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. Mike, maybe we'll have you back when your book comes out. Or when the John Doe decision rises up the ladder.
That'd be great.
That'd be wonderful. Thank you so much to Sam filling in, our engineer today, and for Lois for taking the phone calls. Have a great day. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth has never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base.